You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The proverb, necessity is the mother of invention, dates back to Plato's Dialogue Republic, but it perfectly describes how Israel views its weapons program. Former Israeli President and Prime Minister Shimon Peres argued that the survival of Israel is not conventional, and Yaakov Katz and Amir Bohbot write in their book, The Weapon Wizards, how Israel became a high-tech military superpower, that it was out of necessity that the country's sophisticated weapons program was born. Their book is published by St. Martin's Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Yaakov Katz, the Jerusalem Post editor-in-chief and a lecturer at Harvard University's Extension School, to our show. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Both you and Amir are Israeli military correspondents. How long have you been covering the Israeli military?
I've been covering the Israeli military on and off for the most part of the last 15 years or so. So through the Second Lebanon War of 2006, the Second Intifada, which erupted in the year 2000, which was the Palestinian uprising, and Israeli operations that we've seen in the years since that have taken place in the Gaza Strip primarily.
Had you already served in the Israel Defense Forces?
Yes, both Amir and I are veterans of the Israel Defense Forces.
So did that give you an insight into what you were witnessing?
I think it gave us an insight, but like we portray or we try to describe in the book, I think that's part of the success that Israel's seen when it comes to being innovative in its weapons, is the fact that there's no real degree of separation. In other words, because most Israeli men serve in the military, when those Israeli men then go out and become engineers or go work in high tech or whatever it might be, they understand the needs, right? They fought on the battlefield, so they saw what they needed when they were on operations in places like Lebanon or Gaza or the West Bank. And then when they go into the drawing board room where they're thinking about what's the next weapon or what's the next drone or what's the next gun that Israel might need, they actually experienced it, so they know firsthand.
One of the units that you describe as the best representative of the IDF's investment in manpower is Talpiot. What is Talpiot?
Talpiot is like the ultimate creme of the crop of what Israeli soldiers can do within the military. They take the best and the brightest. These are people who are high school graduates that have gotten A pluses across the board, are experts in physics and math, and they take them and they give them a education in all of the different military units, and they show them the Air Force and the Ground Forces and the Navy, and then they ask of them to come up with new ideas, to come up with new inventions. It's basically a multidisciplinary education, but it's aimed at getting these young folks to be able to come up with innovative weapons and tactics for the Israeli Defense Forces.
What is the word Talpiot?
Talpiot is like a looming tower or a high tower. It comes from like a fortification. So that's the idea that these people are fortifying Israel's security and future.
And it was created after the Yom Kippur War in 1973?
Right. It was created after the Yom Kippur War, that debacle where Israel found itself surprised when it was attacked by Egypt in the south and Syria in the north. It found that just the fact that it has some superior military weaponry, it has some tanks and air force, but that's not enough. And it needed to come up with a qualitative military edge. And that's what Talpiot was essentially created, to try to help Israel maintain that QME, that qualitative military edge.
But the idea of Talpiot wasn't embraced by all branches of Israel's military. Who objected and why?
Well, I think you find, you know, we point out in many different instances throughout the book that you have sometimes visionaries. You have people who come up with the idea like to establish Talpiot. You have people who come up with the idea to invent drones or to build an Israeli satellite when there were only 7 countries in the world that had satellites, all big superpowers. And there was always pushback. There were people who said, no, we can't take these gambles. We can't take these risks. We're a tiny little country with no real resources. Israel, unlike its Arab neighbors, doesn't have oil, doesn't have gas, or now just discovered gas, but doesn't have anything that makes money. It only had the Jewish brain, the brains of the people who arrived in Israel after the state was established in 1948. So you always had people who were much more conservative who said, we can't take these risks. But you had the visionaries who, I think with a lot of chutzpah, right, with just pushing through, perseverance, determination, managed to get these projects, these units, these weapons off the ground.
I'm speaking with Yaakov Katz, whose book, The Weapon Wizards, co-authored by Amir Bohbot, is available from St. Martin's Press. Well, Israel, you note, has been developing new military technologies for almost its entire existence. Has that served the purpose of fueling the arms race
throughout the region?
Yes.
Look, I think so. I think that when you take a look at what's happened, for example, take the drones. Israel was the first country to invent drones. Israel has
using toy airplanes initially.
Correct. They bought toy airplanes here in New York City, shipped them back to Israel in 1968, attached little cameras to their bellies and flew them over the Suez Canal to see what the Egyptians were doing. But you look at drones today where they're used to gather intelligence on Israel's enemies in Lebanon or Gaza or other places. They're used for targeted assassinations throughout the region, also by other countries. But now you see that also Hezbollah, Israel's arch nemesis in Lebanon, has used drones and flown them into Israel. You see that Hamas, a Palestinian terrorist organization based in Gaza, has tried to fly drones and infiltrate into Israel. So sometimes you see the weapon that was developed by Israel for Israel's survival is now being used by these by these terrorist organizations against Israel.
And how many of them are actually Israeli-made drones? Because Israel is also a major arms supplier. You have no guarantee if you sell some drones to Russia, let's say, that they're not going to wind up in the hands of the Syrians, an enemy of Israel.
100%. And these are risks that you take at times. You try to sell it to your friends. You try to put in place measures and safeguards to prevent the proliferation of that technology to the bad guys, the people you don't want it to get to. But these are always calculated risks. So, for example, in 2010, when Israel sold Russia drones, it sold Russia older generation drones, not the most sophisticated ones that Israel uses.
And Russia wasn't sophisticated enough to come up with its own drones?
It's an amazing story in of itself, but Russia, after fighting a war with Georgia in 2008, discovered that it was lacking in a drone capability. And for the first time in Russian history, it came to Israel and asked to buy drones. Russia until then had not bought any military platform from any other country.
A number of Israel's developments have led to problems internationally. For example, not just the drones and selling them to enemies, but Iran complains that Israel's nuclear program is Israel's allowed to have it while they're not. And then, of course, there was criticism in the past when Israel was selling nuclear capability to South Africa during the apartheid period. So some of these weapons, sophisticated weapons developments, can get into rather murky territory.
100%. I think that when you're dealing with a country like Israel, which is just now about 69 years old, which has found itself from its inception surrounded by countries and enemies that wanted to push it literally into the sea and to destroy the Jewish state, that at times you create alliances and you forge some of them that might be murky, that might seem a little sketchy at times. But these were done, I think, really, like you said in the beginning, when your back is up against the wall, you have sometimes no alternative but to try to do some things and think out of the box. And I think that that's what Israel's success is.
The drones originally were designed simply to spy on Egypt, for example. But when did they become weaponized?
Israel doesn't officially confirm that its drones have the ability to launch missiles, but we see around the world that this use of drones is quite extensive by other countries. The United States uses them, for example. Israel reportedly began to weaponize, not the drones themselves don't attack, but they shoot missiles that can then attack.
What Israel's calling the Scout, or I don't know what the
Scout was one of the earlier model drones, but today they have the Heron, they have the Hermes, they have all these different types of drones, very sophisticated. They can stay airborne for 24, 40 hours at a time, and they can reportedly carry missiles, which can carry out strikes.
And the Scout dates back to 1982, so we're talking about a program that has been around for quite a while. You write that what makes drones appealing for militaries is that they can successfully carry out 3D missions, dull, dirty, and dangerous. What does the dull refer to?
Well, imagine that you need to keep eyes on your coastline. For example, Israel has a very long border with the Mediterranean. To put someone in a helicopter or in a watchtower or on a ship, that's a boring operation, and there's not a lot of excitement in that, and there's fatigue. But when you put a drone up in the air, in the sky, You don't have to refuel as much. The drone doesn't have to eat. The drone doesn't have to go to the bathroom. The drone can just stay up there for long periods of time. And that is something that gives you a unique ability to better use your resources, which are anyhow limited.
And what about dirty?
Dirty is, let's say, for example, you have to fly into an area that's been infected by a biological or a chemical agent or even a nuclear disaster zone, and you don't want to put a pilot in harm's way to collect evidence or to see if there are survivors. You can use robots instead.
The U.S. drone program has become a subject of great debate. Does Israel share its knowledge about drones with the United States, or does the United States share what its developments on drones with Israel?
100%. Keep in mind that America's first operational drone came from Israel, right? Back in the 1980s, America found that it was lacking a drone capability, had invested tens of millions of dollars, and programs were failing, and they came to Israel and bought Israeli drones after seeing the success that Israel used of drones in the 1980s. So there's a lot of cooperation there. There's a lot of technological sharing and intelligence sharing that goes on. And I think that it's a mutual beneficial relationship. Israel gains from American assistance, but America gains from the Israeli tech and intelligence know-how.
But you also said earlier that Israel hasn't necessarily confirmed some of these things. How did that make it more difficult for you to research this book?
Well, The Weapon Wizards, I'd say, was written while we were trying to straddle two different kind of lines. On the one hand, trying to cover the daily events that were taking place in the military, and you want to maintain those relationships that you have with your sources. But at the same time, pushing people to kind of reveal the behind-the-scenes stories of how did we get these weapons? How did Israel get these drones? How did they create their first big tank called the Tank Merkava? How did we develop a multi-tier missile defense system? Israel's the only country today that has different systems that can intercept short-range rockets to medium-range rockets to ballistic and intercontinental ballistic missiles. So there are scientists that we discovered in our daily coverage of the military, and it's just routine operations. We were able to meet the people behind this.
You said earlier that service in the IDF has helped to fuel the rise of innovation in weapons. But isn't the IDF reporting that more and more men are avoiding military service, either on religious grounds or as a result of the culture wars? Are they preparing for the possibility of future conscripts?
This is a very big problem today for Israel, the fact that you have a growing percentage of the population of 18-year-olds who are looking for ways to dodge the draft and not to have to serve in the Israeli military. And I think that today already we're at a point where you maybe have about 50-60% of young men and women who are coming to serve in the military at a time, if we go back 20-30 years, it was much higher, which basically means we spoke about that unit Talpiot. Their advantage is because it's a mandatory compulsory service, they're able to choose who they want. So they see, for example, the military sees all of the results of tests and they can pick, I want you or I want you. But if you don't have those people, they're not coming. How do you get the best and brightest? So that's a big challenge.
Were the Orthodox allowed to resist military service in the past? Well, is this a more recent development as a result of some of what goes on in Israeli politics?
Israeli politics today definitely play a role in it. But this was, I would say, the original sin, if I could call it that, was struck back by our founding father, David Ben-Gurion, after the state was established in 1948 with the leaders of the ultra-Orthodox community. But then there were just a few hundred who were sitting in yeshivot in these higher academies to study Jewish studies. And they were just a few hundred. Today, it's blown out to be in the tens of thousands. And this is an untapped resource, a pool of talent that Israel should be using, should be getting not only into the military, but also into the workforce.
I'm speaking with Yaakov Katz, who's editor-in-chief of the Jerusalem Post, also a lecturer at the Harvard University's Extension School. He and Amir Bochbat, the military editor and senior defense analyst for Wala, Israel's leading news website, have co-authored a book called The Weapon Wizards, How Israel Became a High-Tech Military Superpower. It's published by St. Martin's Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Yaakov Katz. His book, written with Amir Bochbat, is The Weapon Wizards, How Israel Became a High-Tech Military Superpower. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And you mentioned the tanks, another program that Israel has developed but a really closely guarded secret, is the Merkava tank. What is the Merkava tank?
The Merkava tank is the primary tank, the armored vehicle that Israel, that the IDF uses today. But it came, it was born out of a problem. Israel back in the 1960s found that countries weren't willing to sell it tanks, right? I don't know if you remember, but there was, after the Six-Day War in 1967, until then, France was Israel's main supplier of weaponry. But Charles de Gaulle, after the war, when Israel tripled in territory and conquered the Sinai, the Golan, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and, of course, Jerusalem, decided we're not going to be supplying Israel with any more weapons. There was also the British that Israel thought it could buy some tanks from them, but they also decided to stop the delivery. So Israel had no choice but to develop its own tank. And today the Merkava is possibly, you know, we could argue about it, but some will say it's the most sophisticated and high-tech tank that you will find on the battlefield.
Do Israel's potential enemies also have tanks?
Israel's enemies, well, it depends which enemies we're talking about.
I said potential enemies.
Well, the potential. So the Syrian military still does have tanks. I'm not sure how much of a Syrian military there still is after 5-6 years of the civil war there.
Well, but they have, they're friendly with Russia, so they may very well have Russian tanks.
They do have Russian tanks.
Which would be pretty sophisticated.
Correct. And but the primary enemies that Israel faces today are not those with tanks. It's Hamas in Gaza. It's Hezbollah in Lebanon. Their primary use of force is with missiles and rockets that they fire into Israel, mainly to terrorize Israeli civilians.
So what would a tank do against Hamas?
And I think that's the amazing part of the story, is that until, you know, back in the, I'd say 5-6 years ago, many countries, Western states, were starting to think these tanks aren't relevant anymore, where we don't have these World War II-like battles where the German tanks are on one mountain and one hill and the American tanks on the other hill and they're just volleys of fire across from one another. That's not how wars are fought anymore. These are asymmetric conflicts. So why would Israel need its tanks? But we mentioned Israel's limited resources. Israel took its tanks and it turned them into these high-tech machines that are able to also adapt to the changing battlefield. If I could just give you one example of a technology, Israel found in the 2006 Second Lebanon War that its tanks were coming under major fire from anti-tank missiles. So it developed a system called Trophy, the only one of its kind in the world. It's basically a missile defense system. It's installed on a tank. A radar detects an incoming anti-tank missile, and then it shoots off a cloud of countermeasures to intercept that anti-tank missile. So the tank can be adapted to even these asymmetric battlefields.
And you mentioned, too, the Kalanit and then the Advanced Tsayad.
Correct. The Tsayad Hunter, in Hebrew, is a digital army program. It's basically like having a screen, kind of like the screen in your car, but it tells you little dots of where the enemies are located. So it's all interconnected with other IDF units that are deployed on the battlefield. They all talk to one another. And if I'm one unit that's deployed on one hill and I see an enemy on another hill, I can just kind of point my finger on that screen, and that dot will appear in all of these Tsayad screens being used by IDF units.
So even if these tanks aren't engaged in tank warfare, they can go and probe enemy positions.
They can probe enemy positions. And I think that when you have such high-level situational awareness, right, like Tsayad gives you the ability to really see a battlefield like never before, you can use precision-guided munitions. You mentioned Kalanit. That's just one example that can actually target very accurately the enemy that you're looking to go after.
One of the next developments you write about are satellites. Wasn't Israel worried that if the Americans knew they were trying to build their own satellites, they might cut off some of their aid?
That was a real risk back in the 1970s, 1980s. But the necessity for the satellite came from the fact that Israel tried to get satellite imagery from the United States, tried to get it from other allies, and wasn't able to obtain what it felt that it needed. So it built its own satellites. And keep in mind, this was at a time when you only had superpowers with satellites up in space. And tiny little Israel, in the mid-1980s, launched its first satellite into space.
And now Russia, France, Japan, China, India, the UK, anybody else other than Israel?
So since Israel, there wasn't really anyone until just a few years ago when Iran launched its own satellite into space. And I think that this, again, it touches upon what you spoke about before, this arms race that you're always trying to stay Israel's always trying to stay one step ahead of its adversaries and its enemies, but they're closely behind. And this is a race that requires of Israel to always try to maintain this qualitative edge.
And Menachem Begin put an estimated $250 million into the satellite program. Doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot of money for a small country. Where did Israel get the money?
Israel got the money from a lot of different places, but part of it was, you mentioned even before, South Africa, which it had a dodgy relationship with. Some of that money came from there. But it came from within the Israeli defense budget, and still today it's tightly budgeted, but it helps Israel create this capability. Right now it has about 7 to 8 satellites in space as we speak, spy satellites.
Wasn't most of the Arab world in particular upset by how the satellite was launched and not the satellite itself?
Well, it's an interesting point, is that you launch a satellite, but what's the vehicle that gets the satellite up into space? And when, you know, a lot of countries can maybe build the sensors for the satellite and build their own satellite, but can you have an independent satellite launching capability? And Israel proved that it has that as well. But look at that vehicle.
Missiles.
Right. So that satellite
launch
vehicle,
which right now
vehicle,
is a source of tension between the United States and Iran.
And Iran. So that missile that Israel used to put a satellite in space is a missile that potentially could be used. You talked about Israel's purported nuclear program. That's a missile that could also potentially be used to carry a nuclear warhead throughout the world. So missiles that are used to carry satellites can also carry large warheads.
I've always wondered about nuclear war in the Middle East. If
God forbid.
Well, if it occurred, if one of the countries dropped a bomb on one of the other, near their neighbors, wouldn't they also be affected?
You know,
because radiation travels.
Right. But Leonard, you're raising a question of as if we're dealing with rational actors. And I'm not sure that when we look at throughout the Middle East today, are the people and the different players that we face, particularly the non-state actors like Hezbollah or ISIS or Al-Qaeda that's out there, or even Iran, do we know, are they really a rational actor? If they were to one day obtain a nuclear weapon, would they use it? And let's even just say there's just a 5% chance that the Iranians would use a nuclear weapon. Is a 5% chance something that Israel could live with? A tiny little country that has no strategic depth. Can Israel run the risk of allowing a country that threatens to wipe it off the map to obtain the capability that would allow it to do that?
But the Iranians can say the same thing. They have faced any number of threats from Prime Minister Netanyahu about attacks, preemptive attacks, preemptive strikes. And we'll get into Stuxnet in a little bit.
Right. But Israel has never threatened to destroy another country. And even in Iran's recent testing of its ballistic missile just last week, it writes on its missiles, this is to wipe Israel off the map, to destroy Israel, right? Their president speaks at conferences with posters behind him that say in 5 or 6 different languages, destroy Israel. So Israel, does it have a nuclear program? Does it not? It doesn't say, but it seems that it does. But Israel never threatened anyone with nuclear annihilation like the Iranians have.
How did the United States respond to the Israeli satellite launch?
They were upset in the beginning. They were upset to see that Israel had this capability. But they, I think, quickly understood that a strong and safe Israel is also an American interest, right? For a long time, and we could bring this up to the current peace process or the non-existent peace process with the Palestinians, but I personally believe, and I think this has been the American approach, at least under the Obama administration, is that if you want Israel to make brave steps or concessions towards peace, you need Israel to feel safe and secure.
And Israel notifies its allies if it spots any suspicious activity.
Of course it does.
From the satellites.
Of course it does.
Even though this is all secret, it's not 100% secret.
You have today amazing coordination and cooperation between Israel and other countries around the world. And I can tell you stories that came out in recent years of Israel discovering a nuclear reactor being built in Syria, right? And Israel took action to take out that nuclear reactor. We write about this a bit in Weapon Wizards. But the fact remains that had Israel not taken that action, can you imagine a scenario today that Syria, a country that's now overridden with ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and other types of different terrorist groups, would have nuclear weapons, would have a nuclear reactor? So this cooperation is something that crosses the globe and is something that I think connects today. There's a growing understanding around the Western world of the challenges that Israel faces are challenges that you're seeing being played out in other places, particularly Europe as an example.
My guess is Yaakov Katz, who with Amir Buchbaum has written The Weapon Wizards, How Israel Became a High-Tech Military Superpower. It's published by St. Martin's Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You're right. Since Israel's inception, defense ties and particularly arms sales have played a role beyond their clear economic purpose of bringing billions of dollars into the Israeli economy. Surrounded by hostile Arab states, Israel has leveraged its superior technology and military expertise to establish diplomatic ties with countries like Russia, China, Singapore, and India. So some of those countries are enemies of each other, and some of them are friends with enemies of Israel. Isn't this a complicated situation?
It's a very complicated situation, but it's a situation that sometimes you need to find allies where allies can be found for that convenient moment. And you found, for example, with China, that at one point in time, Israel was one of the biggest arms suppliers to China. For the last 12-13 years or so, Israel has had a complete embargo on sales to China because of how it upset the United States, and Israel had to make a decision. Does it prefer its strong alliance with the U.S., or does it want to continue to endanger that with arms sales to China? And Israel made a decision. It stopped selling to China. But at the same time, by selling weapons to different countries and arms, you also create some sort of diplomatic maneuverability. It gives you the ability to influence those countries and to try to get them to maybe change their decision-making process. So you saw that with the drone sales to Russia. Israel wanted to stop the Russians from delivering a very sophisticated missile system to the Iranians called the S-300. And Israel debated, should it sell those drones? Like you mentioned, can you trust the Russians? How do you know it won't reach some of Israel's enemies? But Israel calculated and decided that it wasn't its interest to sell them older model drones, but to delay the delivery of the S-300. And it worked for a few years.
But blowback is always an issue. In 2010, Israel was the first known country to launch a military cyber attack. Stuxnet against Iran. It had been developed with the United States, but Israel did it unilaterally and upset the United States. And as a result, Stuxnet has wound up being used against Western countries, not by Israel, but by Iran, which, as a way of defending itself, became quite sophisticated as far as cyber terrorism is concerned.
Cyber warfare is this new dimension of warfare that I think we're just starting to realize that it exists and starting to see how it plays out, because it plays out in the shadows. It plays out on the computer networks that we don't see. You can, like Stuxnet did, take out a nuclear facility and a uranium enrichment facility, Iran's primary one in Natanz, without firing a single shot. And that's an amazing capability. But the question is, what does that lead to? What's next? And if you have it, do other people have it? And that is something that, on the one hand, Israel's built up a formidable offensive capabilities, but it also needs to create the defensive measures to protect itself.
Well, Iran is a country with a lot of very smart people as well, and they figured out what had gone on. And as I said, they used Stuxnet against Western countries. I don't know whether they've used it against Israel, but Stuxnet really became known when, I think it was some German company found out that it had been infected with it, and that had been the Iranians sending it back.
Yeah, Stuxnet was an example of a cyber weapon that leaked out, essentially. It got a little out of control, but it was also highly effective. And when we look back, for example, to 2010 and 11, I remind you that Israel was speaking about the possibility of an overt strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, something that could have led to a major regional war. So when this was done, it was done with, I think, the intention of trying to prevent that war, trying to set back and delay the Iranians' nuclear program. And to some extent, it succeeded. When we saw the P5 plus one reach their deal with the Iranians a year and a half ago or so, that deal was, I think, largely put in place by the fact that there were sanctions, but also their understanding that there are capabilities out there that can do damage to their nuclear program and prevent them from obtaining the capability they so much want.
In your conclusion, you write, wars, especially those against non-state actors, did not end on the battlefield. They continue in the media, in the courtroom and around the UN Security Council table. Public support today means far more than it did a decade ago, and lack thereof can end a war before military objectives are met. So how does that affect what Israel is doing these days, especially since it's been censured in the UN, not for this weapons program we've been talking about, but for settlements? But Israel is not winning the media war in most of the world.
Well, I mean, the UN is a unique example. I just heard from Israel's ambassador to the UN the other day that in the last 10 years, there have been 250 anti-Israel resolutions, and how many against Syria? Just eight. So I don't know that we should look to the UN, but you're right. Israel is very sensitive to the way it's perceived around the world. Israel looks to obtain the international legitimacy for its operations. And I think that's the right way to do things. Israel is a democracy, a law-abiding country, and acts within the space of what is permitted according to international law when it comes to the way it wages war and when it comes to other dealings that it does within the country and throughout the world. So what this means is essentially, if you don't have the world's backing, that operation, no matter how just you might feel, how legitimate you might feel it is, that the other side started, they attacked us, it doesn't make a difference. You need the world to support you, because if you don't have that support, then you, as a democracy, because Israel wants to retain that democratic character, it won't be able to continue.
And when we talk about Israel, we're really talking about a country where not everyone agrees. In fact, as far as I understand, public opinion often split 50-50, pro some of these policies and against some of these policies.
100%. Israel, it's like the famous joke, you know, you put a Jew on an island and he'll build two synagogues, and one he goes to and one he doesn't go to. I think that within Israel, you have a pluralistic view. And that's the beauty and the vibrancy of Israel's democracy, the fact that there is such a vibrant debate within Israeli society and among the people there of what's right for the country and going forward. And when it comes to the peace process with the Palestinians, when it comes to Israel's relationship with this new Trump administration here in America. And I think that we also show that to some extent in Weapon Wizards is this culture of informality, this idea that there's no such thing as structure within Israel, right? We're known for being a people that just has a lot of chutzpah, right? We say what's on our mind. We're very straightforward, but that enables you to innovate. That enables you to have a free flow of information, an exchange of ideas that enables you to essentially excel. And we should hope for that that can be applied also to the way the country is run on a state level, right, when it comes to diplomatic relations.
Yaakov Katz and Amir Bobot have written The Weapon Wizards, How Israel Became a High-Tech Military Superpower. It's published by St. Martin's Press. And my great thanks to Yaakov Katz for being on our show.
Thank you very much.